folks. Eric Stackelbeck here. Welcome to the Watchman Newscast. Speaking of doing God's work as an historian, as a true watchman on the wall, Victor Davis Hanson, one of the world's top historians, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, best-selling author many times all over, and author of the brand-new book, The End of Everything. An amazing read, folks. Hey, beach season here, summer read. I'm a history buff. You have the ultimate guide for your journey through the annals of history when you pick up a book by Victor Davis Hanson. He joined me on Stackelbeck Tonight. Remember, that's our brand new daily show on TBN every Monday through Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time, with a re-air at 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time every night. VDH, Victor Davis Hanson, joined us to break down not only the situation in the Middle East and the ripple effects of that, but he really keyed in on the United States. The struggles we're having in this country, where I'm standing right now, can this thing be turned around? And the consequences if it doesn't? And the role that faith and turning back to God and national revival plays in all of this. So how do empires rise and empires fall? Here's my interview with Victor Davis Hanson. It seems this move by the Biden administration sends the worst possible signal at the worst possible time to the enemies of the free world. Do you see this as a pattern that's been developing over the past few years? And where does this ultimately lead for America?
Well, anytime the United States exhibits a distance between us and Israel, then opportunistic actors in the region fill that void. And we saw that when the Biden administration came in. As you remember, we restored financial aid to Hamas. We got rid of the terrorist designation of the Houthis. We tried to get back in the Iran deal. And they took note of that. And then they also calibrated the flight from Afghanistan, the failure to do anything about the Chinese balloon. They had noticed that Russia had invaded Ukraine in three of the last four administrations, but not during the Trump administration, who was no longer there. They kind of ossified the Abrams Accord negotiations. And as a result, Hamas, Hezbollah, and Iran decided it was an opportune time to attack. And then, of course, this administration is ambiguous. That's charitable, but they have now cut off aid. And I would just add very quickly, remember that the Trump administration, Donald Trump was impeached by the Democrats on the allegation that legislatively approved military aid to Ukraine had been delayed because of supposed political concerns. And I don't think they were political. They were about genuine concerns of corruption with the Biden family. But nonetheless, I think everybody admits that Joe Biden is delaying this aid or canceling or suspending that's been approved by Congress because he's worried about political considerations in Michigan. And so it's very ironic. And the United States is in a period of, I guess, uncertainty. I don't quite want to say decline because we still have a lot of great strengths, but we're engaging in suicidal conduct on the border with borrowing $1 trillion every 3 months, with 45,000 recruits short, and yet we seem to be, and we just don't recognize it. We're impervious. We just feel that we're indomitable, but we're not reinvesting in our preeminence.
Yeah. Victor, what a dangerous time. Historically, of course, we have a gathering storm, the likes of China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And then here at home, we've seen these widespread pro-Hamas rallies over the past few weeks. You've talked a lot about radicalism on American college campuses. What has been your take on the larger ramifications of these protests?
There's a lot of ramifications. One, I think we've dispelled the liberal myth that there was a difference between anti-Semitism and being anti-Israel. They don't make a difference. When they chase Jews into the Cooper Union Library, they don't ask them whether they support Israel. When they rough up Jews or bar them from going where they need to go in class on these major elite campuses, they don't ask them their political sympathies. So that's one thing. And let's get rid of the other kind of exaggeration or lie that we're just pro-Palestinian, we're not pro-terrorists, we're not pro-Hamas. They're flying Hamas flags. They openly cheer on Hamas. They make no apologies for that. I don't think these universities also are elite anymore. For the last three or four years, Following George Floyd, they abolished the SAT score and the comparative ranking of GPA, high school GPAs for admission. A lot of these students, according to the university's prior standards, which they had assured us for decades were essential for their own prestige and preeminence, they're not qualified. And so they're either giving all A's, like Yale University gives 80% A's, Stanford about 65 where I work, or they water down courses. So a lot of these students, when they're interviewed, you know, what is the river to the sea? What's the river? What's the sea? What does 1947, 48 mean? What is Transjordan? All of these issues that they yell and scream about, they don't know anything. Yeah. So I think people are coming away with saying, these students are very unimpressive. If I were to hire them, they would go straight to human resources and complain, and they don't have analytical or computational skills. Yeah. And so that, I'm not saying all the students, but this, and then finally, I think people finally understand there is no dichotomy in the Democratic Party between a radical squad or BLM or Antifa or radical Greens or the Middle Eastern radicals. Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, they're pretty much joined at the hip now.
Victor, I see what's happening in the UK, and it brings to mind two topics that you've talked so much about, the effects of mass immigration on the West and the decline of Judeo-Christian culture. Is Great Britain a harbinger of what could come to the United States?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, we let in a lot more, both in a percentage-wise and in actual numbers in Great Britain. We've never been in this territory before. We have 55 million people who were not born in the United States, 16% of the population. That was an enormous challenge to integrate, intermarry, assimilate people in our values. You mentioned the Judeo-Christian tradition as well as constitutional America, civic education. We're not doing any of that. And the result is that we have no idea who's coming across the southern border. We have no idea why they're here. We do know that 100,000 Americans are dying to fentanyl. When we look at Britain, they are not able to integrate or assimilate Islamic populations. And it's kind of ironic because people are coming to Great Britain to use their freedoms and prosperity to really attack both Great Britain and to cheer on or to celebrate autocratic illiberal movements in Gaza or the West Bank or Iraq or Syria, whatever their homeland happens to be. In other words, they could never protest like that in Gaza, even if they were gay, if they were transgendered, all these celebrity causes here, they would be put in jail in their own homeland. Yet they cheer on from a safe distance the very system they fled from.
I think the big question, Victor, a lot of Americans are asking, and great point, by the way, is why? Why would our elites in Europe, in the U.S., across the Western world, why would they allow this to happen? Why the wide open borders?
I think there's two types. I think there's a left-wing elite who feels utopian and they want to help the poor of the world and that they're wealthy enough and influential enough, right zip code, right title, right degree, that they're insulated. So they don't experience the Rio Grande Valley or the inner city of Chicago experience with illegal immigration. And then there's another group, the same political side, but they feel that their agenda does not resonate with 51% of the population. And so therefore they welcome people in both to change congressional districts by using residents in the census counts, but more importantly, they see this as a future investment for larger government, tribal politics, more entitlements, and they do it for naked political purposes. I think that's why the Biden administration is doing this, and it's helped by very naive people who have one reality, and that is they're never going to be subject to the consequences of their own ideology.
Yeah, we're going to talk more about The End of Everything, your great new book, Victor, but you're a military historian, a historian on many levels, but some of the warning signs we see here in the West, do you see that pattern throughout history when empires fall?
Yeah, I think they do. They get very naive and complacent, and they feel that their walls in the ancient world will never be taken, breached, because they're so formidable or their reputations are such. And then insidiously, very gradually, they start not to invest in defense or not to invest in civic education or not to remember that who their neighbors are and how dangerous they are and how dangerous people who don't hate them and want to destroy them are. And they get into situations in which they have no idea what's going to happen. And I think part of that is the part of that paradigm. We're suffering from affluence and leisure and complacency, and we're not investing in defense. We're not investing in civic education. We're financially imperiled with this $36 trillion debt, and we have enemies who want to take advantage of that, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And we seem to think, well, we're the United States. They can't do anything to us, and yet they're on the move, and we don't seem to be preparing for it.
Victor, you talk about not only the end, but I mean the sudden end of empires, not so sudden in some respects, but to some it may seem overnight, the end of Carthage, a Greek city-state, the Aztec civilization, Constantinople. Is that even more possible? I mean, almost seemingly sudden annihilation today with the obvious nuclear factor, nations wielding nuclear weapons, this seems it could happen faster than ever.
Yeah, or with chemical weapons or bioweapons or artificial intelligence. In the epilogue, I talk about all the existential threats. I mean, North Korea has the ability to wipe out South Korea, and it keeps promising to do so. We just ignore it. And not long ago, the Turkish president said he wanted to send missiles and annihilate Athens and over a dispute in the Aegean Sea. Of course, Iran almost habitually says they're going to wipe out Israel. Rafsanjani 20 years ago said that Israel was a one-bomb state, and it was a miracle that all half of the world's Jewry was in one place, therefore making their extinction possible. So we have all of these threats. In fact, one of the ironies was China has threatened to absorb Taiwan and says it really never existed, and it's going to reabsorb it back into the Chinese mainland. And I wrote about that in the epilogue, and all of a sudden the Chinese translator and Chinese edition, which has treated me pretty fairly and has a big market for other books. They told me either to get rid of that line or they were going to cancel it. They were so angry about it, and I couldn't. So they canceled the Chinese edition.
Stunning.
So it shows you that they're very sensitive to this because they're making daily threats about reclaiming Taiwan and then ending the idea of a Taiwanese culture. There would be no dialect that was Taiwanese. There would be no Taipei would revert to being a communist city, and there would be no memory of an independent Taiwan.
This is, Victor, it's stunning what you just shared. And by the way, we mentioned earlier that, look, much of the West is kind of just whistling past the graveyard, so to speak, as all this unfolds and much of it at and inside our doorstep. With the book, it seems, in just listening to you and watching your great speeches and appearances over the years, especially in recent months, did you have a real sense of urgency in writing this book right now at this point in history?
Well, I started out as just historically curious, but the more that I started to study these sudden collapses, I noticed there was a pattern that they all were very naive. They all kept looking to their past rather than the present or future. They all had no idea about the existential threat outside their walls. They all believed that Alexander the Great was a philosopher. He had been trained by Aristotle, or Scipio was with the historian Polybius. So they didn't think these people had the ability or the desire. But if they had been rational and looked at the actual status of their society vis-a-vis the conqueror, they would have been terrified. But there was a sense of complacency about all of them.
We're indestructible was almost the sense. Hey, we've got about a minute left.
Can't have.
Of course. We talked about the decline of Judeo-Christian values, civilization. What, in your view, historically, being such a great historian, what role does that, the collapse of spirituality in a society, does that play a major role in the ultimate collapse of the society writ large?
Yeah, it does. From a very pragmatic view, when you have a population that doesn't believe in transcendence, that is, that their conduct on this world will affect in some way their soul in the next, then they live for the moment. They feel that this is all there is, the corporal existence. There's no transcendence. I don't have to worry about what I've done, either evil or good. It's all here, and therefore I'm going to satisfy my appetites. That's a much greater propensity. Our wisdom is completely knowable, and we can find out everything there is that makes the world operate by human agency. And there's no mystery that's resigned to a deity or religion. It's all explicable, and that's kind of the arrogance of the Enlightenment. And we're in that stage now with our universities especially, where most people feel we are God on earth, and then we have to be because there's nothing else, and there's no such thing as a soul, and there's no memory of what we do on this earth. And collectively, that can be really dangerous for society. Our founders knew that. Even the ones that weren't Christians believed in deism, that Christianity was valuable for the body politic, even if they didn't believe in it.
Yeah, it could lead all to a dark place, Victor, what we're discussing. But thank God we have you shining a light in the darkness, as always. Victor, thanks so much for joining us. Incredible insights from the one and only Victor Davis Hanson. Again, folks, the book is called The End of Everything, How Wars Lead to Annihilation. It's really a book for such a time as this. You can pick it up wherever books are sold. A great summertime read, and it's not depressing, despite the title. It's an eye-opener, and Victor Davis Hanson is an optimist, but he's clear-headed, clear-eyed, as you just heard. That was a lot of information that you need to hear, packed in a short space of time. Hey, many more interviews like that on the Stackelbeck Tonight Show. Again, a quick reminder, every weeknight, Monday through Friday, 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time and 10:30 p.m. Eastern Time on TBN. And while you're at it, be sure to subscribe to the Watchmen YouTube channel right here and click the notification bell so you get alerts every time a new video is posted. Thanks so much for joining us here on The Watchmen. Until next time, God bless you. And remember, never hold your peace.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for checking out The Watchmen Newscast. Make sure you hit the subscribe button so you never miss an upload. And tap the bell icon so you're notified every time a new video is posted. And don't forget to share your thoughts, insights, and comments below. Thanks for watching. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
They say that nothing fails like success. Well, nothing fails harder than experts either. Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Chris Martins, and today we're going to continue our conversation about the Common Knowledge Game and experts and how badly they have comprehensively failed us all. I'm doing this because I want you to understand that the era of trust is over. We just can't trust people to do their jobs anymore, particularly so-called experts. We're going to carry on the conversation, common knowledge and expert failures. Remember, we've been talking about common knowledge, which is when everybody knows that everybody knows something. Then it pops into common knowledge, and that's when you get really fast changes. Things can really get moving again. I want things to get moving. Let's rip this Band-Aid off. We can tell this junket is headed down into a whirlpool of shame and failure, so why wait? Why pretend? We already have too many issues going on, and the longer we wait, the fewer our options become. We'll be economically bankrupt as a nation. We'll have already been invaded by migrants. We will already have sickened ourselves beyond repair in many cases. Let's stop this, okay? Now, remember, this is the narcissist prayer. This is what we are stuck in, and this is what I want you to be aware of. For a lot of the people in so-called positions of authority, got those positions because they wanted to be in positions of authority, and that's because they are narcissists. We raise a lot of damaged people in our culture, and many of them gravitate and grow up into positions of power because that's what they crave. Like, you crave sunshine and love and food. These people crave power, and they get to these positions of authority, and then they wield it in really awful ways. Yeah, I'm talking about you, Justin Trudeau, and Chrystia Freeland in Canada. I'm talking about virtually everybody, Rochelle Walensky, Fauci, you name it. Most of the people in Congress, senators, they are attracted to power and they will do anything to keep the power. And so they live by the narcissist prayer, which is, hey, it didn't happen. And if it did, it wasn't that bad. And if it was, it wasn't a big deal. But if it is, it's not my fault. And if it was, I didn't mean it. And if I did, you deserved it. Many of us know this prayer from family members, right? It's a pretty common thing to come by. So Thomas Sowell, of course, is the quote machine of the century, and I love his quote on so-called experts. He says, there's usually only a limited amount of damage that can be done by dull or stupid people. For creating a truly monumental disaster, you need people with high IQs. who went to the best colleges and universities. Thank you for that one, Thomas. Hello, everyone. I am Chris Martinson of Peak Prosperity, and my question for you is making sense of the global scene a challenge for you? Are you too busy, maybe, to keep up with all the updates? Well, I have some good news. I offer 120 scouting reports every year to my subscribers, just like the one in this very clip. Save time, stay sharp, all for less than $1 a day. I love that quote, and we're going to be exploring that today. This just came out in February in the Daily Mail, under wellness, and the headline here is, "High fructose corn syrup is just as healthy as honey," says social media's favorite doctor, dispelling common myth. There she is, presumably. No, high fructose corn syrup is a complete metabolic disaster. There's plenty of studies on that. And of course, all you'd have to do is really look at photos of people from the 60s and 70s on the beach compared to today to realize something has gone wrong. This would be an expert you really wouldn't want to be getting any more advice from. But of course, this expert, or at least a favorite doctor, social media doctor, whatever that means, is probably on the payroll, you know, knows which side of the bread is buttered, you know, does what she needs to do in order to continue doing what she does, which is dispensing really awful, terrible, bad advice, but doesn't get any worse than this. Professor Bill McGuire, learning about the power of tweets, had to take this one down, but not before it got screen capped by a bunch of folks. And he said here, quote, "If I am brutally honest," by the way, this is me quoting somebody else. This is how bad this quote is. Make sure we're clear on this. Quote, "If I am brutally honest, the only realistic way I see emissions falling as fast as they need to avoid catastrophic climate breakdown, is the culling of the human population by a pandemic with a very high fatality rate." That came out on May 11th, 2024, not 1934, but, yeah, so a lot of things wrapped up in this. The experts are convinced that climate change is this big thing. Now, they haven't really made their case to me yet. I've heard the stories, right? So here's how it goes. They go, look, if climate gets past 1.5 degrees, then it's lights out. It's game over. And I'm just over here going, well, what happens if climate goes to 1.5 degrees? Spell it out. Like, what happens? It's warmer. Okay, then what? I think what they need to say is what they're worried about, which is some sort of runaway positive feedback spiral in temperatures that creates a wet bulb temperature so that it's no longer habitable for humans anywhere on Earth. Okay, say that. But you say 1.5 degrees Celsius, and I'm thinking, okay, so maybe you can grow orange trees in Georgia now, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, I'm not clear what the impact of that is going to be. So they need to talk about it. But before they get to telling us what they think is really that wrong with going to 1.5 degrees, they're like, well, they've just jumped all the way to the conclusion, which is we have to stop climate change, which weirdly enough is the same thing that will preserve oil and gas and other natural resources for the elites. So I think Bill's just accidentally toting water for an elite position. That's my best guess at this particular point in time. And of course, I base that on where I know we actually are in the energy story. And if you don't know that, you should watch the Crash Course. You really need to understand. If you want to know, have explanatory power for what's going on in the world, you need to understand where we are in the oil story in particular. It is literally one of the most important areas you could devote some time to if you wanted to both explain and predict. Explain what's happening, predict what's about to happen next. Carrying on. Well, how about these people? The Toronto Star, of course, also toting water for other folks. But when they put this out in the context of trying to force people into being vaccinated, they were actually running things that were coming out of nudge unit, focus groups, behavioral psych units, etc. in the military. And we know Canada's military was busy running propaganda, but really they're running fifth generation warfare campaigns. And this is what one looks like in the wild. This is one you could detect here. And so what they're doing here is they're playing on a couple of key things that are core to our social functioning, and they found these to be very effective in the lab and out in the wild, too. And those things are our need to belong and not wanting to be shamed, and shaming being a derivative of the belonging function. If you get shamed, if you do something shameful, that means it's outside of the social norms of your tribal unit. And then, because one, you know, it might be shameful to eat, you know, human flesh in one tribe, but in another tribe it might be shameful if you didn't do that, right? So the shame is context specific to your culture. So they found things that they thought would be really shameful, right? And so they tried, look at all the coercion on this one page. Starting in the top right, they said no jab could mean no job for Air Canada employees. No jab, no job. That is the Harvey Weinstein school of approach to no jab, no job, right? So, and then they said, well, on the other side, on the up there in the top headline, if an unvaccinated person catches it from someone who is vaccinated, boo-hoo, too bad, right? So, oh, that's pretty shameful when your own tribe is saying, we don't even care if you die, right? And then I have no empathy left for the willfully unvaccinated. Let them die. I honestly don't care if they die from COVID. Not even a little bit. Unvaccinated patients do not deserve ICU. Right. So by putting out all this emotionally evocative stuff and making it seem like there's the diseased vermin humans, the unvaccinated. And then there's all these other people who are good, righteous folks who are doing the right thing for everybody without ever squaring up that really awkward circle, which is, if your jabs worked, then why would you care if somebody was unvaccinated? How does an unvaccinated person put a vaccinated person at risk if your vaccines work? They never actually explained that. And of course, you'd have to be a moron to buy that logic and not examine it. But they just rushed it and bum rushed it. By the way, remember this? Remember we had those fake pictures of people dropping in the street in China caused mass panic about the virus, but somehow live pictures of fit young athletes dropping on sports fields after the vax are nothing to worry about, apparently. It's also a very strange dichotomous moment there. Now, you want to talk about experts who can misuse their IQ to create really monumental damage. You could do no worse than to look at this gentleman here, Alistair McAlpine. I spar with him over on Twitter from time to time. It's not that fun. The guy is just absolutely deluded. And here, back in April of 21, he said, fact. COVID vaccines are incredibly effective, 100% against severe disease. We know that's absolutely wrong. And we had data at the time to suggest that was wrong. And oh, by the way, Alistair, if you knew how to read studies, you would know that the Pfizer study upon which you were basing that statement, right, didn't do any of that, right? Didn't study either hospitalization or death. Those were not outcomes that were tracked or anything. They didn't even monitor for them. They didn't report on them. It was just, did people have a detectable PCR swab for COVID-like fragments of viral particles in their body. Nothing symptomatic. So, fact, the vaccines are very, very safe. Severe reaction, 0.005% at worst, no deaths. Again, we didn't have data to support that. That was not a fact at the time, of course. And anyone who tells you otherwise, he says here, is simply incorrect or has an agenda. So this is an example of somebody misusing their authority, their position, their IQ, to really overstate things very, very badly. Now, in my world, doctors should be held to a higher standard. They should be held to account for when they failed to avail for themselves all of the data and to make an informed, risk-adjusted position. So, big fail for Alistair on this one. But Alistair, of course, likes to retweet people like Timothy Caulfield out of Canada, a professor, this guy, even here as recently as April 24th, writing, a large and growing body of evidence shows the COVID vaccine saved millions of lives. No, there's a model that said that, but the model is so deeply flawed, it's off the charts. And by the way, Timothy, you would have to explain why, not your models irrespective, we would have to explain why after the introduction of the vaccines, we now have elevated rates of excess deaths far beyond anything that happened during the 2020 cycle when all we had was COVID itself. And by the way, that first round of COVID that came through in 2020 was Alpha, Beta, and Gamma, and Delta. Delta being the worst of the lot, right? With that D614G mutation and the PRRA mutation, which turned into RRRA, turned it into the pirate cleavage, like RRRA, right? That was terrible. That was really bad. That was 2020. We had no vaccines then, and our excess deaths were indistinguishable from background until we got those jabs coming in January of 2021. And then we had vast excess deaths. So you'd have to explain that. You'd have to account for that. So he said, saved millions of lives, reduced hospitalization rates, unclear. Even the CDC says they weren't collecting the data, so we don't really know. Improved pregnancy outcomes. That is absolutely wrong. And look at what he's citing, examples of studies, The Lancet, SIDRAP, NCBI, JAMA. This is like the worst of the worst. This is the rogues gallery. He's like, look, we convened a bunch of psychopaths and now we're going to cite them all, right? Those are such captured, awful, like complete trust lost. If you really want experts to do a lot of damage with their IQ, those are the links down there. Click on through, see how bad things can go off the rail right there and all those links down there. Reduced severity and incidence of long COVID. Actually, long COVID is probably long vaccine injury now, so it might have actually increased that. Reduced burden on healthcare systems and saved billions of dollars, etc. Absolutely, this is just fraudulently bad, totally fictitiously bad. But why would somebody like Tim Caulfield be saying all this? Why would somebody say something like this? What kind of reasons could there be? Oh, was he paid $380,000 to combat COVID-19 misinformation, Professor Timothy Caulfield? Oh, well, he was here to combat misinformation and conspiracy theories surrounding COVID-19. University of Alberta received $381,788 in grant money from the Canadian Institute of Health Research. So he's pushing an agenda and getting paid for it. That's what this is. This is a paid tweet. It ought to have like an ad on it or something like that. So when it comes to people like these experts doing a lot of damage with their misguided misinformation, you know, flat out lying, all of that stuff, we have to ask, you know, what could it be? What could it be? In Timothy's case, could be, was it rule one at play? Upton Sinclair famously said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his job depends on not understanding it. Is it rule one? Could be. Or is it rule two? Elisa Valdez here writes that, quote, I just heard a podcast in which Dr. Ramani Durvasula, one of the world's foremost experts in narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths, said the medical profession is full of these folks. It's a perfect shield for them, she said. They get complete control and social status. So I'm going to go with rule two for this doctor, Cleveland MD, if it is even a real doctor. You never know on Twitter. Naples, Florida, let them die. I'm so tired of these people. No vaccines for y'all. Writing that in 2021 where there was this big, giant push, and it was a psyop, and it was using the latest and greatest in fifth-generation warfare nudge unit and behavioral unit outputs in order to get people to do a certain thing, and this is fit. So I don't know if this is Cleveland was authentically picking this up because he was misguided by other fifth-generation warfare that he fell for, or if this is part of the paid propaganda army that was out there. It's hard to tell these days. We don't know. But it's just important to understand that is the landscape that we were in and around. And by the way, this would be the last part of this series out here in public. Doctors issue warning as one of the most deadly cancers is on the rise in the UK. And they say climate change is playing a role in the increase. More experts. Beware the experts. There's nothing quite like expert failure. We are surrounded by expert failure, and I'm going to continue that story on. For my subscribers back at Peak Prosperity, we're going to be going on with this. There is nothing that is going to fail harder than this. It's really astonishing, and I've got a bunch of other news. This is a scouting report, and I produce these at least three times a week back at Peak Prosperity, usually Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then on Thursday, I've got a Finance University piece that goes up discussing the economy, and then Friday is my big two-part piece where I'm looking at something in depth. This last Friday, we were looking at, and I sent out an alert, actually, around the solar ejections that were coming. It was a great exercise for people who wanted to understand where they really were in terms of their preparation and being resilient and all of that. So that's what I do at Peak Prosperity. If you like knowing what's going on, I will give you the honest truth as best I know it. When I'm wrong, I'll let you know, and I will amend my point of view. But the most important thing we do is we provide the framing. A lot of noise out there right now. It's meant to divide us and distract us. If you understand the frame of what they're doing and why, then this stuff just becomes noise that's interesting, but it doesn't have to capture you and consume you. All right, with that, I'm going to turn now for all my Peak Prosperity subscribers. Come on back. We've got to carry on this conversation a little further.
Cleveland has quoted a lot the 96% efficacy that was quoted by Pfizer. Do you think that was remotely accurate?
Let's see. Pfizer did the study. Pfizer wrote the study, and then Pfizer said what they said. Nobody independently checked it. And then they wanted to hide their data for 75 years. That effective? Absolutely not. And they did what's called relative risk reduction. Instead of absolute risk reduction, which is what is required for an FDA application. So they're absolute risk reduction, the true effectiveness is 0.86%, less than 1%. So it was never 95, 96% effective, never. It was less than 1% effective from the beginning. And that's from their own data that the United States government forced them to release. So they lied, they hid it. There were more people that died in their trials than in the placebo group. There were more people harmed in their trials than in the placebo group. Their efficacy was a complete lie. If something is not safe, it doesn't matter how effective it is. They knew from the very beginning it wasn't safe, and it's absolutely not effective. And then when other variants came along, they didn't even do the appropriate studies on any.